From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, support for a dissident in China, mixed signals for women in Saudi Arabia, and buying a house in Cuba. The Chinese government recently presented one of its most famous dissidents with a $2.4 million tax bill. The move was widely seen as punishment for the artist Ai Weiwei because of his relentless criticism of the Communist Party. Since then, in an outpouring of support rarely seen for a government critic, thousands of people have loaned Ai nearly $1 million to help pay his fine. NPR's Frank Langfitt caught up with the artist at his home and filed this report.
Ai Weiwei was late. He was with the cops. They'd called him in to urge him to begin to pay his fine.
Well, they said, just pay it. You already have some money, you just pay a little bit, so it shows, you know, you're willing to pay.
After the tax bill became public last week, there was a deluge of generosity fueled by Ai's supporters on China's version of Twitter. Ai says more than 23,000 people have sent in money through bank transfers, cash, and PayPal.
This has happened beyond my, you know, expectation, and I could never imagine. It's, to me today, it still doesn't sound like a real.
Ai says he thinks people are sending money to support his bold attempts at free speech because they don't like how the government is treating him.
People start to release their anger to sending money in. We just send the money as a voting ticket.
Yeah. What do you think the sending the money means?
It means kind of solidarity, it's kind of protest.
The loans, I insist he'll pay them back, have kept volunteers at his studio busy for days. They scan in bank transfers and log them on computers. Liu Yenping, a friend of Ai's, reads some of the messages that accompany the loans.
I'm lending money to the Chinese citizen I most respect. I'm lending money. Pay me back in the next 99 years.
Liu opens a glass case and points to a paper plane made of a red 100 yuan bill. It's worth about 16 bucks and came in over the wall of Ai's compound on the outskirts of Beijing.
It was the night of November 5th. No one was here. Somebody wanted to give us money. When we came in the next morning, Liu Qing, Ai Weiwei's wife, discovered 8 paper airplanes on the ground. It totaled close to $100.
The Communist Party doesn't like the latest attention Ai's been attracting. Global Times, a state-run newspaper, suggested it could amount to, quote, illegal fundraising. Asked about the donations today at a regular press conference, though, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei did not respond directly.
No matter what the people involved do, it can't change the fact that Ai Weiwei evaded a lot of taxes.
With the exception of Global Times, China's state-run media has reported little on Ai's tax problems. Most people interviewed on the streets of Shanghai today seemed oblivious to the case. Here's a 26-year-old who works for a computer hardware company. He refused to give his name.
I've heard of him, but I don't know what happened to him recently. Sure, they can donate if they want to. It may be the public feels there's unfairness involved. I will not give him money. Sorry.
Ai Weiwei is not like most Chinese dissidents. He's the son of a revered Chinese poet. He's also a wealthy artist who helped design the Bird's Nest Stadium for the Beijing Olympics. Most people of Ai's stature are loath to criticize the government in public, but Ai goes out of his way, repeatedly attacking the regime for corruption and political repression. The government has responded by raising Ai's Shanghai studio, holding him in secret detention for more than 2 months, and now hitting him with the tax bill. Ai says he sometimes finds the battle exhausting, and he has a lot to lose. But he also suggests there is a method to what some here see as his madness.
It's a game. If I play like this, may never win. But still, the game is still going on.
Do you think they would be smarter to ignore you?
I think it would be much smarter if they just see me as not existing.
Ai says he continues to challenge the government to create space for personal and political freedom.
Freedom is related to every individual's ability to reach out to the truth, to find solid ground for happiness. And those are so important for younger generation. This is my goal, but don't tell anybody.
The government has given Ai until next Wednesday to pay his tax bill. Ai says he plans to pay some of it, then appeal his case in China's courts. The fight seems likely to continue, which may be just what Ai Weiwei wants. Frank Langford, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, mixed signals for women in Saudi Arabia and buying a house in Cuba. Saudi Arabia's strict interpretation of Islam has long kept women hidden, invisible behind black veils and forbidden from moving freely in public. A few have made the news recently when they were arrested for flouting the kingdom's ban on women driving. More recently, Saudi women received a boost from the king, who promised to give them more political power in the coming years. Yet the prince who's expected to be the next king is known for his opposition to women's rights. These mixed messages from the government are creating mixed emotions among Saudi women, who say they simply want a say in how they live. NPR's Soraya Sahadi Nelson recently travelled to the kingdom and filed this report.
Finding a public place to interview a group of Saudi women in the capital, Riyadh, is no easy task. They and a reporter are kicked out of a Starbucks because it is prayer time when shops must close. A nearby hotel lobby also won't work because there are men inside. Saudi women lingering in the same space as men could trigger a visit by the dreaded mutawa, or religious police, who enforce a strict segregation of the sexes in public spaces. So the women decide to gather in the reporter's small hotel room. But even that proves a challenge as they search for an elevator with no men inside. Noha Al-Suleiman says such obstacles take the fun out of going anywhere.
I feel just frustrated when I go out because I have to find my driver, I have to stay in some places, I cannot walk in all streets, the religious police everywhere, and they can't complain about anything, so I just prefer staying home.
The 28-year-old businesswoman and all of the other Saudi women interviewed for this story say they are tired of waiting for rights most other women around the world take for granted. What especially bothers them is the mixed signals they are getting on whether their government will ever give them those rights. Like when King Abdullah, in a historic speech in September, pledged to add women to his all-male advisory council and allow them to take part in the next municipal elections. 2 days later, a court in the port city of Jeddah sentenced a young mother to 10 lashes for driving a car. The king later set the sentence aside. Even so, analysts say it was an unusually harsh punishment for violating a female driving ban that isn't enshrined in law. 21-year-old university student Ruba calls the sentence shameful. Like many here, she believes it was a backlash against the decision to offer women political rights. Ruba, like several women in this story, asks that only her first name be used to protect her family.
Of course, it felt like a game of tug-of-war between the liberals and the conservatives. When the liberals pulled harder and won, the conservatives pulled even harder. So it just felt like women were that rope between the two parties.
Nevertheless, Saudi women these days are going after their rights like never before, says Fawzia Al-Bakr, a 45-year-old Saudi columnist and college professor who defied the driving ban back in 1990.
I mean, I remember when I go to any, you know, gathering or social gathering or the family, everybody look at you as odd, totally odd, because you're asking for something that is against the religion and against the social, you know, code and all that. Now it's so, you know, I could actually talk to my students about things. It's an interesting time.
She credits greater educational and work opportunities for their empowerment, that and the internet, which has made it easier for women to network and draw attention to their efforts. Like this video Saudi activist Manal Al-Sharif posted of herself driving in the city of Khobar back in May. When she was arrested, supporters quickly created a Facebook page for her and demanded she be released. Public pressure and an apology by Sharif, who also signed a pledge that she wouldn't drive again, led authorities to set her free 10 days later. But the news spurred other Saudi women to get behind the wheel. One is Rasha Al-Dawesi, a 30-year-old banker who says she's tired of paying a third of her salary to drivers to take her to and from work.
The society is more accepting now. That's for sure. Like, you can see people waving to you, giving you a thumbs up and all that. So I think that tells me that society is ready.
But ending the driving ban is not the only change many Saudi women want. Some say more important is for the Saudi government to establish an age of majority for women. Under current Saudi law, a woman is a dependent of a male relative, be he her father, brother, husband, or even her son. She always needs that male guardian's permission to do almost anything outside the home throughout her life. She can even be married off without being told, says Sarah, a 23-year-old marketing specialist.
When we get rid of that law, I will be able to tell you that Saudi Arabia is headed towards change.
Saraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. A new law in Cuba allows Cubans to buy and sell residential property for the first time in 50 years. The reform is President Raúl Castro's biggest nod to market economics so far. As Nick Myroff reports from Havana, the move has the potential to attract millions in investment capital and to transform Cuba's neighborhoods.
A first-time visitor to Havana immediately notices two things about the city: the graceful architecture of its buildings, and the fact that so many of them are in ruins. But walking through the crumbling Centro Havana neighborhood this week, there was another sight: homeowners beating back the decay on nearly every block. Antonio Tresol and his son were heaving cement blocks off a delivery cart, finally fixing an exterior wall in their home that had been patched over with ugly sheets of scrap metal. The buildings on this street are spiderwebbed with cracked masonry. Paintbrushes haven't touched them in decades, and their once elegant iron grillwork is now brown and chipping with rust. But with new loads of building materials available in state stores, and everyone now talking about what their houses may be worth, Tresol's got a new interest in appearances. I just have to finish that little part there and I'll be done, Tresol said. We're making it look beautiful again.
No.
For the past half century, there hasn't been much incentive for Cubans like Tresol to fix up their homes, never mind the lack of money and materials. Fidel Castro's communist revolution made nearly everyone a homeowner, but barred them from buying or selling their property, allowing only complicated trades, while others made illegal black market deals. Now, millions of cash-poor Cubans suddenly have a valuable liquid asset. And no one quite knows what will happen next, says Havana architect and urban planner Miguel Coyula.
Well, Havana is a city that shows to be a city frozen in the time. And now you suddenly open the market. You can buy, you can sell. And the question would be, in my opinion, the impact of this in the society, in the market, because we are opening a new opportunity, a new field for which we are not completely prepared. Many people are not prepared.
Small apartments in rundown sections of Havana are now listed for $5,000 to $10,000 in online classified ads. A well-kept single-family home in a prime neighborhood goes for $100,000 or more. But those fire sale prices may not last. The new market is expected to draw big dollars from Cubans living abroad who will buy or repair property through their relatives, since legal ownership is restricted to Cuban citizens and permanent residents. 1926 and the elevator is still working, says Jorge Gonzalez, a black market cement vendor giving a tour inside a seven-story Havana apartment building that dates from the same year. Cracks as wide as a rum bottle spread through the structure. Buildings like this one are probably too far gone to save, Gonzalez said, but others will be restored as long as government stores can keep construction supplies in stock. The government is finally giving people a chance, said Gonzalez. In the past, if they caught you with black market construction materials, they would confiscate them. But now the state is making them available and everyone is motivated. Cuba's government isn't opening the door to a free market free-for-all. Homeowners will still be limited to one property in the city and one vacation home. And with no mortgage financing available and large sums of cash involved, buyers will have to go through government banks and prove they got the funds legally. Still, with so much pent-up demand and many seeing a different economic future for Cuba, no one seems to doubt that the money will be there. For NPR News, I'm Nick Miroff in Havana.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.